Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. On today's episode, we're taking a trip around some of Europe's galleries for some continental art. We'll start things off in Catalonia before nipping to Italy and Austria too. Our guides on this international tour are Ossian Ward, head of content at the Listen Gallery, and Francesca Gavin, the writer and curator. Elsewhere, we'll be donning our glad rags for Vienna's ball season, and of course, we'll have this week's global countdown. That is all ahead today. Stay tuned. Ossian and Francesca, welcome to the programme. Good to have you with us. We've got a very international selection of shows to discuss. Let's start, shall we, in Barcelona. You've just been there, Ossian, I gather, for an event called Talking Galleries.
Yeah.
Was this lots of talk about galleries by gallerists and other people involved in their environments?
No, of course it was, yeah. They do it every year, and increasingly they're being asked to do it in different places, so South Korea was their latest venture. They might start doing it in London and various other places. So they organise talks with, I'd say, great people on the panels, but, you know, I was one of them. But their kind of model has been based on the idea that galleries should collaborate and talk to each other and, you know, sort of advise each other. And increasingly, they've been inviting larger galleries. So obviously, I come from one of the larger galleries. A lot of the talk is about what is a mid-level gallery, what is a emerging gallery, what's a mega gallery. But I think it's essentially to be a bit collegiate, which we not always are as galleries, and then talk about ways out of those problems. You know, what? How do you do this? How do you grow with your artists? How do you not let them go somewhere else? How do you buy things online? You know, It's really kind of deep and complex. It all goes onto YouTube, so it'll all be viewable. But, you know, I think Talking Galleries does it better than most.
And Francesca, that's interesting. Do you think that's the sort of initiative, actually, the kind of forum that we probably need more of? Because, you know, we're very wedded to the idea of face-to-face conversation at Monocle in all that we do. And there is no substitute, is there, for getting together and actually kicking around some of these
big issues? I'm definitely aware that everyone's really looking for new models, and that really comes out of conversation. Like, I become really fascinated by things like Condo in London.
Yeah.
Or Okie Dokie in Dusseldorf, or in Copenhagen, there's a whole project called Pro Temp, which is really interesting, taking over galleries in between their major shows with emerging artists.
Yeah. Vanessa Carlos was there talking about Condo. Elizabeth D was there talking about her different art fair models. It's really interesting.
I think that's really what's buzzing at the moment. I think everyone's really trying to find something outside of the straight art fair, because I think collectors, galleries, everyone's frustrated with this just supermarket style experience of art. And how do we bring people back to galleries? How do we actually make things more exhibition based rather than just about sales? It's really interesting. I think we're definitely looking for a new moment, partly because I think a lot of people are struggling financially.
And they were coming from all over the world to learn this. So there were people from Australia, people from Africa, you know, people trying to learn how it is they kind of change their models.
Everyone loves a symposium, don't they? I love the word symposium. It feels so ancient Greek.
It was quite good. There was a bit of fighting on stage as well. Not kind of proper fighting, but, you know, it got a bit tasty and a bit interesting, which is also what you want. You don't want everyone to just agree and go home and, you know.
Yeah, you need a bit of edginess. Yeah. But what about the point you mentioned that, you know, everyone's under pressure? These galleries are mainly pursuing a commercial agenda alongside whatever they're trying to do in terms of their programme. Can you truly sort of work together and collaborate if you are in, to a greater or lesser degree, in sort of competition with one another?
Yeah, and that was one of the interesting things, because they said, well, look, you know, all the young art galleries go to the fairs and they make the fairs look cool. They bring solo booths of people and suddenly the rest of the fair looks curated and interesting, and the big galleries are guilty of not doing that. So why shouldn't the big galleries then support the young ones who they're not in competition with? And in fact, if they don't, or if they're not part of that ecosystem and they ignore that, what will happen is that lower level dissolves away, as we're seeing with the mid-level, which is kind of struggling really badly. And then you've got this kind of either very low-end market and very high-end market, a kind of luxury retail market, and nothing in the middle, nothing to support that system to keep going. So it is beholden to us to make sure that, you know, we look after the little guys as well.
Okay, well, let's sort of dig a little deeper into the rich history, really, of art in Barcelona, of course, Austin, where you were and where this was happening. The first art gallery in Spain was, of course, there. I mean, it's a big city. It's an important international art city, but it's not in the sort of upper reaches. Is what you saw there across the board and what you were talking about, is that suggestive that Barcelona's time is coming.
Yeah, and we were talking earlier about shows that Fran had seen that she was really raving about last year, which I didn't manage to see. There aren't so many excuses to go there. There isn't a big art fair. You know, what does Barcelona need? It doesn't have the Bilbao effect of the big Guggenheim. But actually, having been there, not only is MACBA great where Talking Galleries was hosted, you know, that's becoming a moment. You know, the Talking Galleries is a bit like having a gallery weekend or something where professionals come, and you need a moment in the calendar to attract people, because as we know, the Art World calendar is absolutely chock-a-block with all these other things. They hosted it in MACBA, so it's, you know, I'm going to talk about a couple of the shows in MACBA were great. You know, it does have all the ingredients, that city. You know, it's just lacking that kind of moment where everyone comes at the same time. But why not? You know, Barcelona's a nice place to be.
And maybe, Francesca, is there a way, actually, without that sort of signature marquee announcement, the huge new space or the big high-profile fair, if you sort of work, again, in a sort of collegiate way, if all the various people who are stakeholders in it decide to sort of push the agenda, you can make real inroads, right?
Yeah, completely. I think you're seeing a lot of galleries coming together and thinking about collaboration. What's interesting, the last time I went to Barcelona, which was in July, I got very interested in this kind of rise of new foundations, that there's actually a lot of private collectors opening new spaces in El Born, so like in like accessible locations for an audience, showing interesting, good mid-level artists. Mm-hmm. And I actually found that quite exciting. I felt freshness was there, but also the curators are just incredible. Really like underrated curation, political curation in a way, because I love cities that are slightly off-center, let's say, because actually those are the places you really get to experiment with content. You usually have tighter budgets. You can say things a little bit rawer. It's really interesting. I think there's a lot of opportunity for something interesting to happen there. Well, it needs more younger spaces.
It's an interesting moment, I guess, with this whole, you know, Madrid, Catalonia sort of discussions at the moment, that we always talk about the context within which you're looking at things, and that's very interesting. Let's dig in some of the things you saw.
Yeah.
Also, maybe at MACBA, starting perhaps with Joan Brossa. Tell us a bit about this. We're in the sort of Catalan...
I think what they're... Obviously, beyond Juan Miró and Tapies, the big key artists of that town, who else have they got to shout about? So this was a major survey of a kind of Spanish surrealist or a Catalan surrealist in that mold, you know, a bit like same sort of time as Marcel Brute or something like that, concrete poetry, collage. It's definitely an interesting show, but I think playing to what Francesca was saying about the curation, I was much more interested in the other exhibition on at the same time, which is of this artist called Rosemary Castoro, who's actually American. She died in 2015, and this is her first major survey anywhere. And if you go to New York, people do know who she is. So she came up in the 60s. She was a dancer and a painter, kind of hung out with Yvonne Rainer. Then she married Carl André. She was Carl André's first wife. And so you can see that milieu, the conceptualist milieu she hung out with. I actually did the show totally backwards. So I started with her later work, which is all quite large-scale sculpture and quite sort of Eva Hesse bodily stuff. But kind of going back through her life, I was like, wow, she's an incredible abstract painter to begin with, like these amazing, colourful paintings with these odd Y-shaped things which all clash together. She gets more and more minimal, more and more conceptual, and then she starts kind of moving into performance art. She does these amazing street works where she goes out into the street with bits of tape or paint to create these huge areas of New York that become like a conceptual hole or a gap or a crack in the street. And then she kind of turns into this later kind of Eva Hesse mold where you get these amazing larger sculptures, and you can see the dance. There's also these amazing performative images of her kind of roped up in her studio, like you've probably seen that famous Matthew Barney film. But she was doing this in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, you know, really interesting.
And we're talking a little bit about, you know, the sort of the art of curation. How does this stuff work in the space? Obviously, you approached it, I like it, anti-chronologically, which is an interesting challenge. But
like, yeah. Benjamin Button.
Yeah, exactly. The man who views exhibitions back to front. But does it sort of, it feels like it works in the space, and I guess the later, more minimalist works must look quite striking in the MACBA setting.
Yeah, and also I think, you know, the colourful stuff is at the beginning, and actually working your way backwards was, maybe that's a quirk of the MACBA space. It's quite difficult to work out where you are at any one point. There are threads that go throughout, like the dance thing, and people were saying there is this thread that runs throughout the show of the dance and the performative and all of that. But it's also interesting to note that she kind of rails against this idea that she's just a female artist. There's a lovely letter where she says, "I just refused being in an all-woman show in Germany because I don't believe in segregation." And she's at a time where actually women artists are not being noticed, but yet she refuses that kind of that label. She says that, you know, artists already a minority. Why would we want to be further ghettoized by sex or race or whatever else, by style? And it's really interesting to see this attitude when, you know, we're desperately trying in the art world to kind of redress these boundaries. And I walked around with someone who did know her work and was like, this is amazing, you know. And it's definitely the biggest survey of her work ever staged and in a museum. And why at MACBA, you know, how did they come across it? It's really interesting.
Well, Rosemary Castro's work is on show at MACBA until I think the 15th of April, so plenty of time. Prentice, yeah. Will you be tracking that one down?
Sounds... I actually quite like the idea of feeling a little... It's warmer over in Barcelona at the moment.
Definitely a nice
feeling a little light. My skin is feeling very pasty.
Yes, let's go.
And there's always, you know, some good food and drink there. Not that that should ever influence our...
Cava sort of... and oysters last time I was
exactly.
there.
Exactly. That's not the agenda we're supposed to be talking about, but it's hard to resist. Elsewhere in the city... Austin, you also caught an exhibition of work by Alex Reynolds.
Yeah.
A Spanish artist, despite the naming convention, perhaps suggesting otherwise.
Yeah.
A show titled, in translation I understand, This Door, This Window.
Mm-hmm.
Who is Alex Reynolds? And what did you see through this door and this window?
Well, I didn't know her work before. And really interesting, there's just one film, which is about 20 minutes long, and then it's kind of really interesting end piece, if you like. So not much in the space, but this beautiful film where she... I guess it's her, there must be friends of hers. One guy's on a drum kit in a big rehearsal studio, other lady on the floor. She's using her body to make sound and music, and you get all the rustling and the kind of the noise. He's not really drumming. He's throwing his drumsticks around. He's pulling his drum kit along the floor. So you get this kind of weird reverberation, this kind of echoey sound, but it's creating its own kind of music. And then there's some voiceover, which, even though my Spanish is okay, I confess to not getting all of it. But there's this kind of musical element to this kind of rehearsal and play. So you watch this film and you kind of get into the rhythm of it. And that's another tiny work in the corner. But anyway, you leave to go up the stairs. And actually, as you walk up the stairs, every third stair is covered in felt. So you kind of create this beat where you just like unwittingly creating your own music. And so at the end, you kind of leave going, oh, I'm there, you know, I'm in the... Yeah, so it's a really clever show, even though it's kind of quite minimal. Don't know if I know her work or where she might crop up next, but really interesting.
Interesting stuff. And I guess those are themes that we find of enduring interest, aren't they, Francesca? Like a notion of sort of disrupting the viewer's expectations and actually sort of challenging them to become either a sort of a piece of the work or to be directly, almost as Austin described there, walking up the stairs, physically sort of to engage with it.
It's
not just playful, it's interesting, isn't it?
We all know that everyone's really drawn towards immersion, at the idea of an immersive space. But I think sound in particular is something I'm seeing a lot of artists really work with and experiment and incorporate into exhibitions. I've been thinking about this for my upcoming shows I'm curating, literally thinking about how do you create something that changes the environment someone's in on a totally visceral level. That's the amazing part about sound. So yeah, no, I think it's a really, what a smart way of incorporating movement and
great.
The audio.
Clever stuff from the Bilbao native, I think. Alex Reynolds is on show at Estrania de la Mota until the 16th of February. Francesca, let's turn to you now and head to Fondazione Prada in Milan for a show kicking off in a couple of weeks' time, I think.
Yeah, I like being, as Ossian's towards the end of his show, as mine are at the beginning. We're just, you can seamlessly go from one space to the next.
Marking the listeners' cards. This is what we like. Post Zhang Tum Tum, I believe. Mm-hmm. Art, Life, Politics, Italia, 1918 to 1943. Well, a period of time where quite a lot of interesting things were going on. Tell us why you're particularly looking forward to this
one. I am so excited by this show. I think this sounds like... But I mean, it's really fascinating. It's curated by a guy called Germano Celant. What's specifically fascinating is, I mean, I love the Fondazione Prada anyways. Everything they do has been incredible. But they're really looking at the context of art. So there's 500 artworks, but it's looking at the context politically, architecturally, like socially, magazines, private letters, writings of people like Moravia and Carlo Levi alongside all these incredible movements that balance both the avant-garde and this aestheticization of fascism, which I think is something very apt at this moment in time when we're seeing such a rise of far-right politics, literally looking at how the propaganda machine used culture. It sounds truly, truly special.
Well, I'm always wary about broadcasting the political dynamics of the current age onto periods of time and shows that do that. But again, it feels like an expedient piece of scheduling, because I guess part of the dynamic in that interwar period in Italy was sort of liberalism and fascism, these two sort of conflicting forces and the way that they shape the cultural output. And as you mentioned, there's extraordinary things you think of sort of the futurist movement around the time. Presumably that's all going to be reflected on. And there's a tension there, I suppose.
I mean, it's really fun. I mean, obviously, yes, a lot of the futurists are represented, people like Bala and Severini and Cara, as well as people like De Chirico and then Morandi. So it's like, I mean, it really is the greatest hits of 20th century art, like the people that really counted. But what I find really, I really believe the idea that art doesn't live in a vacuum, because we're living in our moment in time. We look at an exhibition, we know whatever those references are, whether it's looking at your mobile phone or something that we've seen on CNN, or something you listen to on Monaco Radio. But what's so interesting, when you're looking back in history, how do you recreate an experience of an artwork so you can get a glimpse of how it's actually perceived by that time? We're so at a remove of that, and we're so obviously looking at through the gaze of post-war, post-fascism thinking, that I think it's really interesting looking back and seeing how those kind of, how politics and society and art and design all intertwine and shape location. Milan is specifically, I think, a really interesting place to be doing this. Somewhere that obviously is so known for design and architecture, and you really feel it walking through the streets. It has such a reputation of being an industrial city, and it really is, and it's incredibly beautiful. And I think this exhibition is doing a really good job of not obviously focusing on the artworks, but really showing it within a broader context.
Mm. They're actually sort of partly or fully reconstructing viewing areas of the period? Is that how this is going to work? Is this the idea?
I think so. It's actually really interesting. I saw another show in Berlin recently, which called the Schwarze Years, or the Black Years, which was again focusing on this same period in between the wars and how that affects the growth of a collection and how whatever the ideology who is in control, they're definitely looking at all those massive giant exhibitions like of sport or like of fascism and all these big, huge Uber shows, and how does that influence what work is being seen and how people are seeing things. And a lot of these things are like insidious within culture. Obviously, it's you think like an average person working in a shop, let's say in Turin in 1932, is not necessarily uber conscious of whatever contemporary art is coming out at that point. But what's so interesting about shows like this, it highlights how the avant-garde or the political seeps its way into the everyday and what that relationship is. I think it sounds like a really fascinating idea.
Do you think they're going to go, because we know a little bit about the fascist leanings of the futurists and how that turned out, but then the kind of the received style afterwards, because obviously the fascists were, you know, they didn't want to support something so avant-garde. They actually went, there was a sort of much more figurative movement.
Yeah, ultra-classical.
The Novecento came out of that. Do you think it goes into, I'm not quite sure whether
that. No, it does. It goes Novecento, Roman school, Les Italiens de Paris, that kind of neo-impressionist movement. What's so fascinating is when you live in different countries, you go to a different country, you think you just know everything about that. But there's a whole entire wave of post-war realist painters in Italy in like the 50s, which are like the art equivalent of, I don't know, Visconti, etc., like that you're not seeing. And I think this is basically looking at the 1930s, showing the breadth of what Italian art is in a really international context.
You can catch Post Zhang Tum Tum at the Fondazione Prada in Milan from the 18th of February right through till summer, towards the end of June. Next to Vienna.
Mm.
We find work by Cypriot artist Haris Epaminonda. Francesca, tell us a little bit about who she is, first of all.
I'm such a fan of her. She actually studied in the UK. She's based in Berlin. And I've been watching that girl for years. And every exhibition I see of her gets better. It's incredibly fascinating. She had a big installation. She took over a whole house as part of Documenta 5 years ago. So that's probably how she's known in a wider space. She's represented by Rodeo, who are a Turkish gallery now based in London. Imagine the idea of like collage, but sculptural. So that's like referencing ideas around classicism, around classical architecture, that kind of Cypriot history, about the idea of history itself, and minimalism, the work is becoming less and less in a lot of ways. It's almost like the hint of the outline of something now. And she basically makes these assemblages that are like 3D collage works, but they're always fascinating, usually quite monochrome. Sometimes they used to involve like things torn out of an old book on Greece, let's say, but now they're much more, I don't know, they're just getting tighter and tighter. And I really like the Secession, you know, whatever solo shows that they've been doing there in the past year, even though people in Vienna are complaining that they're not as experimental as the space once was.
Well, I was going to ask you about this because, of course, its sort of founding idea, I guess, was that it was about a revolt of sorts against prevailing small C conservatism, I guess, in the sort of broader art movement there. It's kind of, you make a bit of a rod for your back, though, I guess, if you're sort of all about pushing the boundaries.
Well, we need places that do, but the Secession isn't that anymore. I think the Secession's really become a place where very good mid-level artists are getting major solo shows. I mean, we've had R.H. Quaitman, Alex DeCorte, and the exhibitions are great, but they're well-paid-for exhibitions. It's not like an ICA or a Kunsthalle in that sense. It's very much like a pretty serious, straight solo show, well-funded people. But saying that, Harris Epaminonda definitely deserves a solo show, and I'm sure she'll make it fascinating.
Does Vienna have anything like that in terms of, like, really? I just get the feeling that it's not that kind of a place anymore.
I'm so excited. I've been spending a lot of time in Vienna because I've been visiting lecture on Gelatin's course in Linz, so I've been in there a lot. There are some amazing, there's a whole wave of young galleries and project spaces opening up there. It's actually, I think it's quite an exciting city. I was quite surprised. Obviously, we're not in that whole like Hermann Nitsch actionist, even Gelatin like grime, but it's still like a reasonable place, and there's still space to do interesting things. And particularly young galleries, I think, are really interesting. I think Vienna's having a moment there, maybe just because I like it.
And just tell us more about the way that the show actually works, because I guess in former works there were actually some, I don't know if they'd almost be performative elements.
She's done video-based things.
And living things being involved into the works as well, into these kind of sculptural collages.
I mean, it's not often so alive in that sense. Sometimes she's done video pieces and there's been incorporation of projection or found imagery within it, but it's very much coming from a sculptural point of view. It feels like sculpture to me. They're hinting what's inside of the show, but it's not actually quite clear. But in terms of how shows normally work with Secession, there's always two solo shows on at the same time. One person's room is stuck with the Klimt in there, or the Klimt like around the top in one space. But it's basically a pretty classic, straight exhibition space between two artists. So yeah, there's another one on at the same time. I actually didn't check who that was. I was too excited by Harris's work.
On your list, Ossian? It's on until the 1st of April from the 9th of Feb.
And I've only ever seen very small displays of her work where you get that feeling that you've kind of seen them before and they're perhaps repeating. And I think she's interesting.
I think the idea of repetition is really fascinating. The idea of like, how are you constantly reworking your own themes? And very much intertwined with ideas of this kind of post-ancient history, contemporary view of the classical. And the history of minimalist sculpture or just image making, I find that really interesting. I like, she would often like place things leaning against walls or half seen, or she would work with the architecture a lot. So I'm expecting a lot of architectural insertion.
Head to the show. It's at Session Building in Vienna from the 9th of Feb until the 1st of April. Ossian and Francesca, thank you both for joining us today. Now, speaking of Vienna, the city's been in full swing recently during its winter ball season, waltzing mandatory, the dress code formal. Some balls are centuries old, but there's a somewhat new one in town, hosted by scientists and celebrating smarts and diversity. Monocle's Vienna correspondent Kimberly Bradley took to the dance floor to explore and to report.
Ball season in Vienna runs between November 11th and Lent, hitting its peak in January and February. It's a heady time when Viennese throw glittering events, crack out their tuxes and ball gowns, revel in tradition and pomp, and cut a waltz or two. One of the newest balls on the scene is the Vienna Ball of Sciences. Taking place in the ornate, chandeliered rooms of Vienna City Hall, it kicked off in 2014, in part to highlight a forgotten part of Viennese culture. Co-founder and co-chair Oliver Lehmann explains.
The sciences always have been a bit in the backdrop, at least in the last couple of decades. This was not so 100 years ago, because arts and science then developed in parallel. So what we are doing here is bringing science back into the front of the stage, and giving science the kind of audience and publicity it deserves.
Vienna's New Year's Eve and opera balls are world-renowned, but there are hundreds more. Professions and groups like doctors, lawyers, technicians, even coffee house owners, confectioners, and weightlifters host balls. It's been a Viennese tradition for centuries.
Funnily enough, and strangely enough, scientists didn't have their own ball until very recently. A couple of universities had their own ball. So this turned out to be a very good idea to present science to the local public, but also to the international public.
The Ball of Sciences was also in part a response to the Akademiker Ball, or Academics Ball, renamed by the Viennese faction of the right-wing Freedom Party in 2013. Professor, now President, Alexander van der Bellen, as well as Vienna Mayor Michael Heupel, asked Lehmann to launch a ball honoring research and science. But how do you infuse science into a glamorous evening?
What I did was I took the format of the ball with the very traditional opening of the debutants entering the hall, the very traditional midnight extravaganza, which is called a midnight quadrille. I took all these classical elements and I preserved them, but I thought about how to, what I call, charge the format with science.
Amidst the waltzing couples are scientific displays and interactive elements. Guests this year enter photo booths that take portraits with no wrinkles. The atmosphere is elegant, but also upbeat.
We reserve about half of the tickets, of about 3,000 tickets we distribute and sell, to students at a very, very low price of 25 euros. And this means that the whole ball is very young, very lively, contrary to many other balls, which can appear a bit stiff and old-fashioned.
And while it helps to be well-trained in the waltz, the ball has multiple dance floors with different music genres.
Of course, at the center of it all is the grand ballroom. And this was actually purpose-made for the Rathaus when that was built 140 years ago. And apart from that, we'll have jazz, we'll have soul, we'll have Latin. And this is important. People don't sit at a ball. Obviously, you can get yourself a table and a box, welcome your guests and host your guests there, but you move.
The halls are filled with revelers from here and around the world, with Austrian university directors and a few science VIPs, like Caroline Weinberg, who co-chaired the March for Science in the United States last year.
Oliver reached out to me, having read an article about the co-chairs, and asked if I would be interested in coming to Vienna. And I wasn't going to say no to coming to a ball in Vienna. And so that's how I ended up here. It's just incredible. I mean, the building's amazing and everyone's dressed very fancy. It's very impressive and overwhelming.
The multicultural international audience and focus on knowledge sends a strong message. The Ball of Sciences symbolizes the part of Austria that's less in the news lately.
So this all adds up, and the main idea is to adhere to the classic format, never to lose that, and to charge this with science, with fun, with entertainment, what we call excellence, openness, and diversity.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
Thanks, Kim. Well, now we're in the dancing spirit. What better time to have this week's Global Countdown? And Fernando is back. Fernando, welcome.
I'm back.
Very exciting. Now, you're back, but we're heading off to somewhere. Where are we headed?
To Brazil.
Excellent.
And so I decided, you know, because Carnival is next week, but Brazilians are already celebrating. So I thought it would be nice to look at what are actually Brazilians are listening in the charts. So basically, we're going to hear quite a few of the songs that will be massive during Carnival. And it's interesting because I was dying actually to come back to the office because I read the story that words that contain the word but or any of its variants are everywhere in Brazil. I know it's been always a trend, it's not a major surprise, but there's been a research, Tone, just last year between August and December, 48% of all Brazilian songs being streamed contained that word. And when I say but, it can be even, for example, a song says, the perfect circumference that has the power to drive you crazy.
Okay.
That includes...
But even an oblique reference to the posterior...
Exactly.
...is still in there. Essentially, every other song is an ode to the posterior,
yes,
in a sense. Well, let's see whether they sound that way, if you follow me, as we count down through the top five. Let's start at five. And does this advertise its posterior obsession front and centre, as it were?
It does mention the word big as in a very rude way in Portuguese. Rabiola, which means, you know, a kite as well. There are quite a few meanings, but, you know, looking at the lyrics of this guy, he's a 19-year-old funk artist. His name is MC Kevinho, or MC Little Kevin, as you were mentioning.
Yep.
And the song is Rabiola. I guess we have to listen. It's not very good, but let's listen to it.
MC Kevinho, and you were sort of grimacing, Fernando.
I was. You know how I'm very open. I don't mind a little bit of sexuality in songs, but God, those lyrics, Tom. It's difficult to translate.
It sounded quite jolly to me, but I'm not getting the full...
It was jolly. Even the video, I think they filmed in one of those water parks. Mm. But yeah, it's all about the butt and doing all sorts of stuff.
An acquired taste. He looks like a bit of a cheeky chap.
I have to give you a little bit of background in this. I mean, in Brazil, there's a kind of a culture war because a lot of people are against funk, including some conservative MPs. They want to basically forbid the whole genre in Brazil. Of course, that's quite stupid, you know, but you know, they say the letters are too sexual. They are sometimes quite violent. I agree with that, but I don't think the solution would be just to forbid the whole genre. You know, I think people are free to listen to MC Kevinho if they want.
You've got to engage with it, critique it, as you've done here. Exactly. But then move on. Banning is never the answer.
No.
What's number four? Is it something else that, for good reason or bad, maybe should be banned from the airwaves?
Not really. That's actually the most kind of conservative. It's a typical country song in Brazil from Gustavo Lima. He's doing very well. And the song is Apelido Carinhoso, or is Cute Nickname. That's how would you translate that song. Let's hear a clip.
Now, Gustavo, or Nivaldo Batista Lima, as is his full name, as I understand it, Fernando.
Yes.
Much more clean cut. You know, if you look him up, he's often wearing a blazer, very accurate haircut.
Very clean cut. And another trend, actually, I noticed by accident now, the top four artists, they all have double T's in their names. And it's funny, Tom, because, you know, double T's are very Anglo-Saxon. But in Brazil, we have this trend as well. People are they believe in certain things, in numerology or all sorts of things. So sometimes they add T's to their names.
So double T's is a sort of lucky moniker, is it?
For example, Gustavo Lima, of course, in Brazil, we only need one T to say Gustavo, but he's got two T's. I have to say, it looks very weird to me, but it is certainly a trend that we'll see in the rest of the chart as well.
That's interesting. Okay, well, who is at number three and where do they deploy their double T?
Well, this is Anitta. She's the major Brazilian pop star at the moment, and she wants an international career. She's doing a lot of duets with, for example, Swedish DJ Alessio, with Maluma from Colombia. And, you know, and she likes to declare herself as a businesswoman as well, because she's also helping other younger artists as well. And she says, you know what, I might be a pop star for the next 5 years, but then I think I would quite like actually having, you know, my own label and this kind of thing. So I quite admire her business take of music, and this song is actually very good. I think the beats are excellent. It's Anitta with Vai Malandra. And I have to say, even though, again, we're talking about the butts and everything, the video clip for that song, the first 10 seconds is basically a close-up of her butt when she's walking on the street. But the thing is, some people are saying, is she a feminist or not? Because, you know, she has cellulitis, like, you know, almost a lot of people have that. And there was no Photoshop. And a lot of Brazilian feminists saying, you know, it's quite brave. You know, she's just being, you know, she grew up in the favela. So because, you know, a lot of people judge, why is she sexualizing her image? But she's like, you know, I grew up like this.
This is the reality.
This is
my life.
Yeah. And she's an interesting character to look out
for. Okay. Well, she's at number three with Vai Malandra. Who is at number two? Near the top spot. Not quite.
That's a very interesting one, Tom, because it's Pablo Vittar. Pablo Vittar is a drag queen, but in this video is interesting because she's doing a duet with a Brazilian singer called Lucas Luco. You know, he's a straight, handsome guy. You know, he sings like pop, country. He's quite a random generic singer. So it's quite brave for him to do a very sexy video with Pablo Vittar as well. And Pablo Vittar, you know, looks quite beautiful. I think you're looking at some pictures there. And it's incredible. I think it's the most successful drag queen in Brazil ever. And even conservative radios are playing it and is going to all these Sunday TV shows in Brazil. And it's a great video as well. For those who have the opportunity, it's called Paraíso. It's a mixture of Blade Runner with the Blue Lagoon.
We've got to take a listen to this. Very kind of playful stuff, and it's interesting, isn't it? I find it quite striking that you said that gets play on some commercial stations, even some slightly more small-c conservative commercial stations, which, again, if you watch the video, it's kind of surprising, but I guess it speaks to how, from a Western, traditional Western viewpoint, you would say how generally kind of sexualized the videos and stuff are in terms of the pop scene in Brazil. You talk about the numbers at the top. Is everything hyper-sex? And I guess around carnival time, people talk about it's just in spirit of fun, but does it matter that it reads that way sometimes to people looking from the outside? Or is that to really misunderstand what it's all about?
I think in terms of trans, this hypersexuality, I remember when I was a kid, there was some quite, you know, very sexual lyrics on TV, and it was quite shocking, but at the time maybe we didn't realize. And I think we've been through a phase where we're trying to become a bit more conservative in the imagery, but there's definitely it's coming back, that same hypersex from the 90s in a way, in different ways, in a more feminist way. You know, now we have drag queens, we have women that doesn't need to have the perfect body to show their sexuality as well. So there's been some changes. And I think Pablo Vittar is fascinating. Mm. I mean, we all talk how RuPaul is very famous around the world, but actually Pablo Vittar has more kind of followers on social media than RuPaul. In fact, much more. So that's quite a surprising and striking number as well.
Very, very interesting. Let's look to the top of the tree. Kind of more of the same, perhaps, Fernando? Enlighten us.
It's a novelty hit, and it's called Que Tiro Foi Esse? What Was That Shot? This song is causing a lot of controversy for all sorts of reasons. It's a novelty by a young funk singer from Rio. Her name is Jojo Marantini, or Jojo Todinho. I think she accepts both names. And I think that's her first hit, Tom. And as you can see, you know, we're talking about hypersex. She's
a big character, Fernando. Can I jump in and say that?
Yes, indeed, you know. And in the video, there are some drag queens in the video. And, you know, she's sitting down with Chuma Slimane. And, again, very hypersex. And what's striking, I have a nephew, he's 6 years old. He did a video doing the choreography for that song. I mean, this is how famous this song has become in Brazil. It's literally everywhere. Even the latest...
So does that jump it? Does it go beyond a sort of... You said it's sort of a novelty track, but does it kind of almost go beyond that because it is just so ubiquitous?
Yes.
It's part of the kind of cultural capital now.
Even a little trivia here. The latest Elle magazine, the Brazilian version, just had a... Jojo is not on the cover. I wonder why not. But but the title of the fashion shoot is like, Que Tiro Foi Esse? What Was That Shot? Because Brazilians, it became like a slang. What was that shot? I mean, there's so many meanings for that thing. But shall we listen to it?
Let's take a listen. Chart after all, Faye. What do you think of that at the top of the tree? It's a distinct sound, as you said, and it's very much kind of the moment. Do you approve?
I approve a lot because I think we spoke about in those years how country music has been dominating Brazil. And as much as I don't mind a good country song, I was getting a bit bored. And I've kind of welcomed this new kind of funk singers. And it's more fun than just a boring acoustic ballad from a country singer in Brazil. I think Jojo Todinho is excellent and good for her.
Good luck to her. Certainly plenty of fun in that top five. I feel we maybe need to check in with Brazil more frequently.
I think so as
well. For one reason or another. And ahead of carnival season, that's interesting. I'm sure we'll talk to you more across the station, Faye, about the various kind of cultural impacts that I'll have in the days ahead. But fascinating stuff. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us. And thanks to all of my guests from earlier in the programme, to Francesca Gavin and Ossian Ward. The programme was produced by Holly Fisher, and I'm Tom Edwards. We'll be back at the same time next week. In the meantime, to play us out, well, it could only be that number one track from Jojo Marantini. Here she is. Get you the fancy. Get you the fancy. Get down my house. Get you the fancy. Get you the fancy. Get down my house.